Welcome to today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jim Mitchell, your volunteer broadcaster here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. These are the Journal's business and finance headlines for Friday, November 22nd, 2024. An American investor with a history of deal-making in Russia has asked the U.S. government to allow him to bid on the sabotaged Nord Stream Pipeline 2 if it comes up for auction in a Swiss bankruptcy proceeding. Shares of Temu, parent PDD, fell almost 11% after the Chinese e-commerce giant missed third-quarter sales and earnings expectations. DirecTV has decided to walk away from its proposed merger with rival Dish Network, abandoning a tie-up that the two satellite companies have attempted several times. Huawei plans to roll out its most advanced domestically made phone chip, people familiar with the matter said, showing how it is able to make strides in semiconductors despite U.S. sanctions. Gap increased its sales outlook for the year after reporting market share growth across its brands in the third quarter, sending shares up in after-hours trading. BJ's Wholesale Club raised its earnings guidance after the bulk retailer said it would increase its annual membership fee and would add more fresh produce to its shelves. Workers at France's cognac distilleries plan to go on strike next week over fears that the industry could relocate its bottling business to China to circumvent import tariffs. SEC Chairman Gensler will step down at the end of the Biden administration. And the Dow rose 1.1% on gains at Salesforce and IBM, while the S&P 500 at NASDAQ added 0.5% and 0.3%, respectively. So first, let's turn to the markets with this article. Dow rises on gains by tech firms. Alphabet drop weighs on NASDAQ. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 460 points on Thursday, powered by gains at Salesforce and International Business Machines. Snowflake shares soared after the data cloud company reported higher than expected revenue. Other software stocks posted gains in its wake, including the 3.1% gain in Salesforce, lifting the Dow. IBM gained 3.6%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is about 1% below the closing record it hit last week. The average rose 1.1% to $43,870.35 on Thursday. Markets climbed immediately after the election on expectations that President-elect Donald Trump will usher in lower taxes and lighter regulations for U.S. companies. But the rally has since lost momentum. We got a little ahead of ourselves, said Scott Martin, chief investment officer at Kingsview Wealth Management. Even if Trump comes in with a big spearhead of ideas, it's going to take a while to implement them, he said. The technology-heavy NASDAQ composite edged up 0.03% to $18,972.42, weighed down by losses at Google parent Alphabet. The S&P 500 increased 0.53% to $5,948.71. One area where the Trump trade has kept going, crypto. Bitcoin hit a new intraday peak just above $99,000 on Thursday, continuing its wild rally on hopes of more crypto-friendly policies from the Trump administration. CryptoLink shares were volatile. MicroStrategy shares sank 16%. Elsewhere, crude oil prices rose nearly 2% after Russia fired a new intermediate-range ballistic missile into Ukraine. Moscow notified Washington of the missile firing in advance, U.S. officials said. The first snowfall of the season over Chicago and other swaths of Middle America, and forecasts for frigid weather in the coming weeks have added fuel to the natural gas rally, pushing prices of the power generation and heating fuel to new highs for the year. Futures for December delivery ended 4.6% higher, following an even bigger rise on Wednesday. Natural gas futures have increased 46% over the past month and are now up 15% higher from a year earlier. Overseas, markets were mixed. Japan's Nikkei 225 and Hong Kong's Hang Seng both fell. The Stocks Europe 600 rose modestly. For Thursday, flash purchasing managers, indexes for U.S. services and manufacturing from the S&P Global, are due at 9:45 a.m. Economists polled by the Journal expect a modest uptick in the manufacturing PMI to 48.8, still below the line that divides expansion from contraction. That was Dow rises on gains by tech firms. Alphabet drop weighs on NASDAQ. Now let's turn to our top story. U.S. investor eyes Russian pipeline by Christopher M. Matthews. An American investor with a history of deal-making in Russia has asked the U.S. government to allow him to bid on the sabotaged Nord Stream Pipeline 2 if it comes up for auction in a Swiss bankruptcy proceeding. Stephen P. Lynch spent two decades doing business in Moscow and now wants to buy the natural gas pipeline that runs from Russia to Germany. Argued to U.S. officials and lawmakers that U.S. ownership of the pipeline would provide leverage in any peace negotiations with Russia to end the war in Ukraine and serve U.S. longtime interests. The bottom line is, this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for American and European control over European energy supply for the rest of the fossil fuel era, Lynch said in a rare interview. Lynch, who lives in Miami and was a large contributor to President-elect Donald Trump's campaign, has told people he wants, quote, to be the richest guy you've never heard of. But his audacious plan would thrust the former Peace Corps volunteer into public view. The 765-mile-long pipeline has been a crown jewel of Russia's petroeconomy, linking its vast gas fields in Europe. It was completed just before Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022 and never became operational. It's owned by a subsidiary of Russia's state-owned gas giant Gazprom, a unit that filed for bankruptcy in Switzerland days after the invasion. In September 2022, subsea explosions destroyed one of the pipeline's two trunks. The other remains intact but unused. The Wall Street Journal previously reported that a team of Ukrainians was behind that sabotage. Lynch sought a license from U.S. Treasury Department in February, according to a letter written by his lawyers at Wimmerhale and reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The license would allow him to negotiate for the pipeline with entities currently subject to U.S. sanctions. The letter said there is a hard deadline in January in the Swiss bankruptcy proceeding for Nord Stream 2 to either restructure its debt, which the letter says is unlikely, or face liquidation. Lynch argues that once the war is over, it will be tempting for both Russia and its former customers in Germany and Europe to turn on the pipeline, regardless of who owns it. Lynch has success buying Russian assets on the cheap, earning him a reputation as one of the few U.S. investors able to navigate the country's fraught business and political scenes. He was given a license by the Treasury Department to complete the acquisition of the Swiss subsidiary of Russia's Sure Bank in 2022 after the U.S. sanctioned the parent company. Questions have been raised about Lynch's ties to the Russian government. A civil fraud suit accused Lynch and a group of foreign investors of participating in a rigged auction in 2007 for assets belonging to former oil giant Yukos, which was broken up by Russia after the company was charged with tax evasion. Managers of Yukos Dutch subsidiary alleged the investors conspired with Russian state officials to predetermine the sale of their company at a fixed price. Lynch and other investors denied the allegations. A UK judge dismissed the charges against Lynch and the other investors in 2019, writing that the defendants didn't, quote, indicate any dishonesty during a 25-day court proceeding. Lynch has told people he thinks he can buy Nord Stream 2, which has been valued at around $11 billion, for pennies on the dollar, according to people familiar with the matter. He said many investors won't bid because of the complex geopolitics tied to the conduit, and the other bidders are likely to include Russian proxies, Chinese entities, or others at odds with U.S. interests. A group of U.S. senators, as well as officials at the Treasury and State Departments, have been briefed or informed about Lynch's plan, people said. A representative of the Treasury Department didn't respond to a request for comment. A spokesperson for the State Department declined to comment. Businessmen and former government officials with experience in Russia said Lynch's plan faces hurdles but could gain momentum if he could be used as a chip to negotiate Ukraine peace once Trump is in office. The president-elect has promised to end the war. Lynch gave more than $300,000 to Trump-aligned committees and the Republican National Committee during the most recent election. Lynch, 57 years old, lived in Moscow for two decades, remaining there after many foreigners left as President Vladimir Putin of Russia consolidated power. Lynch, his husband, and their children moved to Miami in 2019 because of concerns about Moscow's social environment and the increasing challenges for U.S. citizens to do business as sanctions tightened, a person familiar with the matter said. After 2 years with the Peace Corps in Russia, Lynch got his MBA from Wharton in 1998. When Russia fell into a financial crisis in 1998, Lynch founded Monte Valley Partners to acquire distressed real estate assets there. He sold most of his stake in a large project to Russian partners in 2007, just as the Yukos liquidation began unfolding. Billionaire Mikhail Khodorkovsky built Yukos into an oil and gas giant following the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but the empire was dissolved after Khodorkovsky fell out of favor with Putin. The idea to bid on Yukos assets came to Lynch as a spontaneous combustion idea, he said, in a 2018 deposition taken in connection with the UK court case. Many would-be bidders stayed away from the auction, believing only those with political connections could win. Lynch said in the deposition he believed the bidding would be competitive and assets could be bought cheaply. Lynch and his partners ultimately purchased more than $2 billion worth of Yukos assets at a steep discount and sold virtually all of it to Deutsche Bank. State-owned giant Rosneft eventually swallowed up most of Yukos assets. Some of Lynch's friends said he has cultivated relationships with Russian officials and that it would have been impossible to be a successful and openly gay businessman in Moscow without them. But the friends said they weren't aware of anything to suggest Lynch had worked to further the interests of Putin or his inner circle. That was U.S. Investor Eyes Russian Pipeline. Next, DirecTV scraps merger with Dish Network by Drew Fitzgerald and Alexander Gladstone. DirecTV has decided to walk away from its proposed merger with rival Dish Network, abandoning a tie-up that the two satellite TV companies have attempted several times. DirecTV said that it informed Dish owner EchoStar it plans to scrap the deal Friday. The decision came after a rebuke from bondholders representing about $10.7 billion of debt in Dish and its DBS subsidiary. The broader tie-up depends on the creditors' approval. In September, DirecTV agreed to buy Dish from EchoStar for a nominal $1 plus the assumption of the debt. The deal started to break apart last week after the companies failed to secure concessions from the key creditor group. Merger's failure poses another setback for the satellite companies and their respective owners, EchoStar and TPG, on saving both satellite operators flagging fortunes by pooling their resources to negotiate better rates for the TV programming they carry. Private equity firm TPG is still set to buy the remainder of DirecTV it doesn't already own from AT&T, but now faces the prospect of managing a debt-laden business without the benefit of future cost savings to lift its trajectory. TPG bought a 30% stake in DirecTV in 2021. EchoStar chairman Charlie Ergen had planned to shed Dish and its Sling TV services to focus on building a new wireless network operator. The company said it plans to move forward with those plans regardless of the satellite merger's outcome. Weeks before a November debt payment threatened to push EchoStar into bankruptcy, Ergen struck the deal to sell Dish to DirecTV. Holders of Dish's DBS bonds rebuked the offer, which would have forced them to take a roughly $2.5 billion haircut on their holdings in exchange for more secure debt in the soon-to-be-merged satellite TV company. That was DirecTV scraps merger with Dish Network. Next, Temu's owners' sales growth slows by Shen Liu and Tracy Chu. Sales of Temu parent PDD Holdings fell almost 11% Thursday on the company's missed third-quarter sales and earnings expectations, highlighting the growing challenge for the Chinese e-commerce juggernaut at home and abroad. PDD delivered $14.2 billion in sales for the quarter, a 44% increase from the same period in 2023, but the slowest sales expansion since the second quarter of 2022. Its net profit was up $3.6 billion, up 61% year over year. The company's chairman and co-chief executive, Chen Li, attributed the slowing growth to intensified competition and external challenges during a call with analysts Thursday. This was the second consecutive quarter PDD missed analyst forecasts after years of breakneck growth. In late August, the company spooked investors after missing revenue forecasts in the second quarter and a downbeat earnings call, driving down its shares nearly 29%. Temu quickly rose to become the U.S.'s second most popular shopping app after Amazon.com by monthly users, but its U.S. growth has shown signs of losing steam. Investors are increasingly concerned about the potential punitive U.S. tariff impact on Temu's operations. President-elect Donald Trump promised to impose tariffs of 60% on all Chinese goods during his campaign. Morgan Stanley analysts said in a note on November 11th that higher than 50% tariff increase would significantly diminish Temu's price advantage over U.S. competitors such as Amazon. Haitong Securities on November 6, after the U.S. election, downgraded PDD to neutral, considering potential geopolitical impact on Temu in the immediate term. Temu also faces increasing competition in the low-cost goods sector. Amazon this month launched a new section on its app focused on items that cost $20 or less as the e-commerce company looks to fend off rising competition from low-cost Temu and its Chinese-founded rival, Shein. Temu has been shifting its advertising budget away from the U.S. to other regions over the past year, partly to limit geopolitical risks. U.S. legislators and regulators have directed a series of challenges at Temu and Shein, as well as Chinese-owned TikTok. While Temu is growing fast outside the U.S., its downloads have been declined from the peak in July of 2023, according to Morgan Stanley analysts. After 2 years of operation, Temu has 49 million monthly active users in the U.S., or 74% of Amazon's U.S. user base, according to Morgan Stanley. PDD's third-quarter earnings were 12% lower than forecasts by analysts polled by the S&P Global Market Intelligence. PDD executives cautioned in August that the profit would suffer as the company invested to address supply chain inefficiencies and reduce fees for merchants. Chen said Thursday the company's third-quarter financial results were within the company's expectations. Over the past year, executives have sought to tamp down investors' expectations for never-ending profit growth, cautioning about regulatory and compliance uncertainties in global markets where it operates. The previous consensus that PDD would continue its fast growth trajectory has been broken, said Yongen Lee, founder of MomentumWorks, a Singapore-based venture consulting firm. The company probably is seeking to manage investors' short-term expectations in a more delicate way. In China, a series of stimulus measures Beijing introduced in September to revive the slowing economy have presented both opportunities and challenges for the company, executives said. While the new measures were intended to fuel consumption, co-CEO Xiao Jingjing, in a rare acknowledgement of the company's limitations, said the company's limited operational capabilities meant it missed out on opportunities to leverage the stimulus. To keep prices competitive with rivals, he said that PDD incurred higher costs compared with peers. The company on Thursday continued to tout its efforts to reduce fees for merchants, an initiative introduced in August following months of protests from Temu suppliers in China against what they considered unfair penalties from the company that left some bankrupt. The company has budgeted more than $1 billion for its fee reduction program for the coming year. Over the past quarter, PDD executives said it has rolled out initiatives including service fee funds, lower security deposits, and an easier fund withdrawal process. The total cost of revenue increased 48% from the same quarter in 2023 due to increased fulfillment fees and payment processing fees. Zhao said the company had invested heavily in compliance, aiming to remove bad actors and empower top performers. JP Morgan analysts wrote in a November 12th note that China's e-commerce market has entered a slow growth stage where industry competition will be less cutthroat due to a slowdown in live streaming commerce on short video platforms. But they expect PDD to continue to gain market share and outperform rivals by leveraging its low-price offerings. The bargain site faces heightened regulatory scrutiny in Europe, including a European Commission's probe over suspicions that illegal products are sold on its platforms. Earlier this month, European authorities notified Temu of practices on its platform that infringe EU consumer law, such as displaying misleading information. That was Temu's owner's sales growth slows. Continuing with Chinese business, Huawei steps up challenge to iPhone by Lisa Lin and Raphael Huang. Huawei Technologies plans to roll out its most advanced domestically made phone chip, people familiar with the matter said, showing how the company is able to make strides in semiconductors despite U.S. sanctions. The chip is set to be included in some phones of the Mate 70 series to go on sale next week, they said. With the series, the Chinese smartphone maker hopes to challenge Apple and build on market share gains since last year. The iPhone maker still counts China as its second largest market after the U.S., but after years of dominating high-end phones, it has faced growing competition from Huawei. In recent days, Huawei has given glimpses of the Mate 70 series online, including showing three camera lenses on the back of the phones, and the company said it would make a product announcement on Tuesday. Huawei hasn't given details of the phone's features or the chips inside them, an area of interest for U.S. policymakers who've sought to hold back Huawei's technology. The company was put on a trade blacklist during the first Trump administration in 2019. A Huawei representative declined to comment on the chips on the new phones. The company's ability to continue making incremental advances in semiconductors is both a security concern for the U.S. and a commercial challenge for Apple. Huawei's overall market share in China has risen to 15.3% in the third quarter of this year from 8.6% in the first quarter of last year, according to industry researcher IDC, and it's been neck and neck with Apple in recent quarters. Huawei's fortunes have improved in part because of nationalistic buying by Chinese consumers and because of features including its powerful cameras. The two companies compete in particular in the high-end market. Huawei's current flagship model line, the Mate 60 series, starts at $690 in China, while Apple's iPhone 16 series retails for about $830 and up in China. Mate 70 will continue to put more pressure on Apple in China, said IDC Vice President Brian Ma. While Huawei's chips still trail Apple's, particularly in power efficiency, this might not amount to much of a practical difference as long as the user is able to get through the day without having to worry about charging, he said. Huawei is taking pre-orders in China for the Mate 70 series and said on its website that around 2.5 million people have clicked a button online saying they intend to purchase the device, although they can change their minds later. Huawei has sidestepped U.S. sanctions with domestic technology. When Google cut access to some of its Android services on Huawei smartphones, the Chinese company developed its own operating system called Harmony OS Next. The coming Mate 70 series, which has three models, will use that software, people said. In August of 2023, Huawei surprised U.S. officials by introducing its Mate 60 series of smartphones with communications capability similar to high-speed fifth-generation phones available in other countries, even though it could no longer access 5G-related technology in the U.S. That was Huawei Steps Up Challenge to iPhone. Next, SEC chair to exit as Biden term ends. Securities and Exchange Commissioner Chair Gary Gensler will step down as Wall Street's top regulator at the very end of the Biden administration, he said Thursday. Gensler had been coy about when he planned to leave the SEC, but he'd been expected to depart before President-elect Donald Trump is sworn into office. He will serve through noon on January 20th when Trump is set to become president. Gensler's decision to remain until the end of the Biden administration probably disappoints some Republicans who wanted to see him go sooner. He could try to push through some additional measures since Democrats will still retain a majority on the five-member SEC as long as he stays. Gensler presided over a hyperactive period in SEC rulemaking. Wall Street groups challenged many of the regulations he pushed through, including a rule that would have imposed new transparency requirements on private equity managers. A court also rejected a regulation that Gensler backed that tried to overhaul how companies do stock buybacks. The SEC also expanded its enforcement campaign against crypto companies during Gensler's reign. That was SEC chair to exit as Biden ends term. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you miss any part of this program or any other of our great broadcast, you can stream it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Now, let's move on to our next article. Gap raises outlook as market share grows by Sabella Ojea. Gap raised its sales outlook for the year after reporting market share growth across its brands in the third quarter, sending shares up in after-hours trading. The apparel retailer on Thursday said it expects full-year sales to grow between 1.5% and 2%. The San Francisco-based company had most recently guided for sales to be up slightly and noted that the fourth quarter is off to a strong start. Shares rose 15% in after-hours trading. Before Thursday's market close, the stock was up 5% year-to-date. Consistent execution of our strategic priorities, including the rigor and repetition we're applying to our brand reinvigoration playbook, is making us a stronger company and demonstrates our continued progress in unlocking Gap Inc.'s full potential, Chief Executive Officer Richard Dixon said. Gap has been looking to modernize its marketing approach to attract more customers under Dixon, who took the top job at the retailer last year. Dixon is best known for reviving Barbie during his long tenure at Mattel and has aimed to reignite Gap's creative culture after years of sluggish sales. In February, he named Zach Posen as Gap's creative director and chief creative officer of its Old Navy brand. The company is working on the recruitment of a new leader for Banana Republic following the departure of Sandra Stengel as CEO of the brand and resetting Athleta. Gap's improved views for its full year as it reported a rise in profit and sales in the fiscal third quarter. The company posted a profit for the 3 months ended November 2nd of $274 million, or 72 cents a share, compared with $218 million, or 58 cents a share, for the same period a year earlier. Sales rose 2% to $3.83 billion. Analysts polled by FactSet had forecast quarterly sales of $3.81 billion. Comparable sales, which adjust for store openings and closing, rose 1%. Meanwhile, online sales rose 7%. Third quarter comparable sales rose 5% at Athleta and 3% at the namesake brand. Comparable sales at Banana Republic fell 1%, and Old Navy's were unchanged during the period. That was Gap raises outlook as market share grows. Now let's switch from clothing to cognac with this article, French Distillery Workers Plan Strike Over China Fears, by Pierre Bertrand. Workers at France's cognac distilleries plan to go on strike next week over fears that the industry could relocate its bottling business to China in a bid to circumvent import tariffs. The strike, called for November 28th at distilleries Maison Hennessy, Rémy Martin, Courvoisier, and Martel, following a walkout this week at LVMH's Hennessy after the business disclosed that it intends to test the viability of sending bulk quantities of cognac to China. Hennessy's move prompts fears that the entire cognac industry could relocate its bottling business to China and potentially to the U.S. in the future, CGT trade unions Michael LaBlanche said on Thursday, referring to possible tariffs that U.S. President-elect Donald Trump could introduce once in office. In response to duties on European cognac shipments that China put in place last month, Hennessy is considering temporarily entrusting its bottling service to a China-based provider, it said. Hennessy said it is evaluating all possible solutions and that nothing has been decided, and said it has no plans to relocate production of the alcohol. Harvesting, distillation, and maturation would always be carried out in Cognac, France, the company said. Rémy Martin owner Rémy Cointreau said it has no plans to relocate its bottling line. Martel owner Pernod Richard declined to comment, and Courvoisier owner Campari didn't respond to a request for comment. Next week's strike plan comes as the European Union and China face off on trade tariffs. Last month, China imposed provisional tariffs on brandy imports from the European bloc, a decision that followed the EU's move to impose duties on Chinese-made electric vehicles. The tit-for-tat measures spurred France's cognac decision-making body, the Bureau National Interprofessional du Cognac, to call on public authorities to urgently find a solution to what is called a political issue causing painful consequences. The cognac industry employs 70,000 people in France and the surrounding regions, the BNIC said. The U.S. and China are major destinations for European-made spirits, and the countries are the bloc's largest and second-largest export destinations, respectively, according to industry association Spirits Europe. In 2023, EU spirits exports to China totaled €889 million, equivalent to about $937.5 million U.S. dollars, 90% of which were made up by grape and mark-based spirits, Spirits Europe director Ulrich Adams said. Adam called on both sides to lift tariffs. That was French distillery workers' planned strike over China fears. Next, BJ's raises membership fee and its fiscal year forecast by Sabella Hoya. BJ's Wholesale Club raised its earnings guidance after the bulk retailer said it would increase its annual membership fee for the first time in 7 years and add more fresh food to its shelves. The Marlborough, Massachusetts company said membership will cost $60 a year starting January 1st, up from the current $55. The increase follows Costco Wholesale's membership increases in July. BJ's shares climbed 8.3% to $92.79 a share on Thursday. BJ's premium club membership, Club Plus, will be more expensive with an annual cost of $120 a year, representing a $10 increase. Premium membership includes rewards and discounts on gas and represents the retailer's most loyal customer base, Chief Executive Robert Eddy said on a call with analysts. BJ's expects to attract more members by adding more fresh foods to its product mix. The strategy is part of a shift that aims to grow its grocery business as consumers remain cautious about big-ticket purchases such as TVs. Overall, BJ's most affluent members are outpacing the growth of the rest of its member base, Eddie said. BJ's raised its guidance for the fiscal year 2024 after reporting growth in profit and revenue during the third quarter. The company expects adjusted earnings for fiscal 2024 to be between $3.90 and $4, up from a prior range of $3.75 to $4. It expects same-store sales growth, excluding gasoline, of between 2.3% and 2.4%. It previously guided for growth in same-store sales, excluding gasoline, of 1% to 2%. BJ's posted profit for the third quarter ended November 2nd of $155.7 million, or $1.17 a share, compared with $130.5 million, or 97 cents a share, for the year earlier period. Stripping out one-time items, earnings per share came in at $1.18. Sales rose to $4.98 billion from $4.82 billion. Same-store sales increased 1.5%. Excluding gasoline, same-store sales rose 3.8%. Now that was BJ's raises membership fee and its fiscal year forecast. Next up, Fruit Loops Become Political Football by Jesse Newman. They're only half-inch across, rainbow-hued and crunchy, and at the center of a political food fight. Fruit Loops maker W.K. Kellogg has been under fire for months over artificial food dyes. Now, high-profile critic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been tapped to become the country's top health official and has vowed to target artificial dyes in cereal that he says contribute to health problems, particularly in children. They get brighter colors in Fruit Loops, but it's literally poisoning our kids, Kennedy said on Fox News in September. Kellogg said the dyes have been deemed safe by scientific bodies around the world. President-elect Donald Trump has nominated Kennedy to serve as Health and Human Services Secretary, offering a platform to pursue his stated mission of combating chronic disease in the U.S. by ridding the country's food supply of harmful chemicals and ingredients. Kennedy says companies know artificial dyes are problematic, but use them anyway because they're cheaper than natural alternatives. Artificial dyes appear in nearly every aisle of U.S. grocery stores. They give foods like Fruit Loops, Skittles, and M&Ms their vibrant colors and help enliven the appearance of items from pickles to pie crusts to processed meat. Most companies over the years have sought to shed additives to appease consumers' desire for simpler ingredients. But U.S. shoppers have sometimes revolted when food makers switched. Some companies sell dye-free versions of U.S. products in other countries, some of which restrict the use of certain food dyes. Kennedy's view on public health matters has been controversial. His critics in the food and health industries say many of his opinions lack a scientific basis, and some say there are more important issues to focus on than artificial dyes, such as the heavy use of sugar in processed foods. Consumer advocacy groups, however, broadly support Kennedy's mission to strip artificial colors from food, especially products marketed to children. California recently passed two laws prohibiting certain food additives, including dyes, and other states have proposed similar legislation. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved 9 synthetic color additives in food, and they said they're safe when used in accordance with FDA regulations. The FDA said the totality of scientific evidence shows that most children experience no adverse effects, though some evidence suggests certain children may be sensitive to additives. Kellogg said its products and ingredients comply with all relevant laws and regulations. The company said more than 85% of its sales come from cereals that don't contain colors from artificial sources. Kellogg Company, which split into 2 separate companies last year, said in 2015 that it was working to remove artificial colors and flavors from its branded cereals by the end of 2018. But the North American cereal business, called W.K. Kellogg, still sells cereals that contain the ingredients. Fruit Loops sold in the U.S., for instance, are made with red 40, yellow 5, yellow 6, and blue 1. In Canada, Kellogg's original Fruit Loops are colored with juice from carrots, watermelon, and blueberries. A Kellogg spokeswoman said that the company would alternate versions because consumer preferences differ across markets and that its dyes are permitted in Canada. Calls for W.K. Kellogg to remove artificial colors from all of its cereals began mounting earlier this year. Jason Karp, a hedge fund manager turned food entrepreneur in March, accused it of marketing inferior, toxic cereals for Americans while safer versions are sold abroad. In September, Karp joined food activist Vanny Harry at a Capitol Hill roundtable on American health and nutrition. They opened 2 boxes of Fruit Loops, 1 sold in the U.S. and 1 in Canada, and asked why children in the U.S. shouldn't get the safest version. Harry, Karp, and Callie Means, a former food lobbyist who advises Kennedy on health policy, traveled to Kellogg's headquarters in Battle Creek, Michigan last month. Flanked by protesters carrying "Ditch the Dyes" and "Stop Poisoning Us" signs, the activists said they delivered petitions urging the company to remove artificial ingredients. Sarah Gallo, senior vice president at the Consumer Brands Association, which represents food manufacturers, said regulations should be based on science. When political ideologies are used to create fear and disregard the role of science, it undermines public trust in food safety, Gallo said. Some food giants vowed nearly a decade ago to remove dyes from their U.S. products, but have since abandoned or reversed those promises. General Mills rolled out an all-natural version of Trix colored with radishes, purple carrots, and turmeric in 2016, but the next year reintroduced the original after consumers complained. General Mills food scientists at the time said that the fruit and vegetable juices produced bland colors and changed the taste. Mars pledged in 2016 to remove artificial colors from all of its foods. Its scientists spent hundreds of hours testing whether radishes and red cabbage could be used in red Skittles instead of red 40. Purple carrots left Skittles spotted. Mars halted its plan in 2021, saying it found that many consumers weren't actually concerned about artificial colors. The company said it would continue efforts in Europe. Now, some food companies are again working to remove artificial dyes to comply with California's new law. Food brand consultant Jeff Grogg, a former Kellogg R&D director, said many companies are taking a wait-and-see approach to the new Trump administration. "The food industry likes clarity," he said. "All the hype and bluster is a distraction." That was Fruit Loops Become Political Football. Moving on, Existing home sales ticked up in October by Nicole Friedman. Sales of existing homes rose in October, reflecting a short-lived drop in mortgage rates that improved affordability for buyers and produced the first year-over-year gain in sales in more than 3 years. The average rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage slid throughout the summer and reached a 2-year low in late September, according to Freddie Mac. Lower rates lured some home buyers off the sidelines and sparked some hope among real estate agents that a boost in activity during the fall could salvage another slow year for sales activity. U.S. existing home sales in October rose 3.4% from the prior month to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 3.9 million, the National Association of Realtors said Thursday. Economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal had estimated a monthly increase of 2.9%. October sales rose 2.9% from a year earlier, the first year-over-year increase in sales since July of 2021. Homes typically go under contract a month or two before the contract closes, so the October data largely reflect purchase decisions made in September and August when rates fell on their way to a low of 6.08%. But rates have started rising again and stood at 6.84% this week, potentially stalling some of the market's momentum. People are accepting that the mortgage rates, the new normal, is not going to be 3% or 4% or even 5%, said Lawrence Yun, the National Association of Realtors chief economist. Home sales in 2024 are still on track to hit the lowest level since 1995. Christie and Mark Seeley jumped into the market in September when they found a 3-bedroom home in Olympia, Washington on 9 acres of land. The home has been sitting on the market since July, and the price had been reduced. The Seeleys offered the asking price and asked the seller to contribute to their closing costs, and their offer was accepted. They bought the home in October with a 5.875% mortgage after paying extra to their lender to reduce their mortgage rate. It was the perfect timing for us because now I know the rates are way higher, Mark Seeley said. We're very fortunate. The recent increase in mortgage rates has reduced expectations for home buying activity in 2025. Many first-time buyers are priced out of the market at current rates and prices, and homeowners with low rates on their current mortgages are reluctant to give them up by selling and moving. Mortgage rates would need to fall below 6% for sales to pick up, said Odetta Kushi, deputy chief economist at First American Financial. Any improvement in mortgage rates is welcome, she said, but people want a 5 on the left-hand side of that decimal point. The national median existing home price in October was $407,200, a 4% increase from a year earlier, the National Association of Realtors said. News Corp, owner of the Journal, also operates Realtor.com under license from the NAR. That was existing home sales ticked up in October. Now let's turn to the Journal's opinion pages and begin with this item, the lessons of Gates' withdrawal. Donald Trump's pick for Attorney General, former Florida Rep. Matt Gaetz, withdrew on Thursday, barely a week after being nominated. There are lessons here, ones the gung-ho Trump team could benefit from internalizing as it continues filling out key posts. Gates' defenders are already attempting to blame his flame-out on smears or on hard feelings over Mr. Gates' role in the ouster of Speaker Kevin McCarthy or on Republican spinelessness. Mr. Gates, in his withdrawal statement, insisted he was unfairly targeted. Whatever the Trump team says publicly, it would be unwise for it to fall for those excuses privately. Mr. Gates' liabilities were all his own, and it was those liabilities that burnt down his confirmation. The biggest was obviously the recently concluded Health Ethics Committee investigation into a long list of allegations against Mr. Gates, including, from a June committee statement, quote, sexual misconduct and/or illicit drug use, shared inappropriate images or videos on the House floor, misused state identification records, converted campaign funds to personal use, and/or accepted a bribe, improper gratuity, or impermissible gift, unquote. The claims weren't limited to the allegation of sexual trafficking previously investigated by the Justice Department. Mr. Gates looks to have convinced Mr. Trump that these probes were no different from partisan Democratic allegations and lawsuits aimed at the former president, or, as Mr. Gates wrote this week, his own Steele dossier. That claim was always ludicrous, even if one is to buy that a broad team of career prosecutors were plotting to take down Mr. Gates, a plot that failed spectacularly as they never brought charges. The House probe was conducted by Republicans and Democrats on a panel known for its reluctance to throw stones, given that its members live in the same glass house. Yet bits of the Ethics Committee report were starting to leak out, and everything pointed to its findings being ugly. And so, lesson number one. Not all allegations against Republicans are partisan shams. That's surely hard for Republicans to swallow in light of witch hunts against Mr. Trump and Brett Kavanaugh. But the GOP, as the law and order party, has a duty to make careful distinctions. The Trump transition team might have also read the insider room. Republicans are well-versed in defending their brethren against nonsense attacks, even their unpopular brethren. There was a reason few, if any, Republican members rushed to Mr. Gates' defense. They know him. Congress is a closed space, and almost all members have seen or heard something unpleasant enough to make them suspect fire accompanied by smoke. Ergo, lesson number two. Take your lead from people who know, not MAGA Twitter insurgents. The name of the Trump nomination game is clearly shakeup, and that's to be applauded. Few doubt that Washington is in desperate need of some rattling. But note lesson number three, the Gates fiasco is a reminder that there remains a bright line between a candidate who is aggressive, committed, and professional, and one who's unthinking, partisan, and a liability. Mr. Trump has chosen a solid lineup of the former, from Linda McMahon at Education and Marco Rubio at State to Chris Wright in Energy and Brendan Carr at the Federal Communications Commission. Mr. Gates was always clearly the latter, big on bravado, short on ideas and temperament. While not as discussed as the ethics question, it's also an important reason his nomination was destined to fail. Every politician faces a tension between party loyalty and constitutional principle. For all that Mr. Trump has rightly complained about Justice Department politicization and the need for change, his team underestimated how seriously senators take the problem and how focused they are on this vital opportunity to turn things around. They want someone serious and aggressive, but also someone who can command the respect necessary to rebuild trust among all voters in the department. The temptation may be to pick another loud candidate made popular by catering to the base, rather than one with a true commitment and plan for restoring the Justice Department's fealty to the Constitution and to the rule of law. But such a pick won't reassure senators who are truly eager to rally behind a rock star with a unanimous vote. And of course, it's possible to tap a candidate able to both shake things up and to promote professionalism. The Republican firmament is teeming with past or current state attorneys general, former prosecutors, and other legal heavyweights, many who also have knowledge and experience of the Justice Department structure, its problem staff, and potential barriers to reform. Mr. Trump has 4 short years and a lot of fixing to do. He needs an attorney general who is already sprinting on day one. And the country deserves it. A Justice Department that's doing its job is a department that isn't leading every headline, that isn't the source of nonstop drama. Starting with a drama-free nominee would be a great start on that future. That was the lesson of Gates's withdrawal. And finally, this from the opinion page, Crisis and Compassion at 38,000 Feet by Bob Green. Mr. Green's books include Once Upon a Town, The Miracle of the North Platte Canteen. The flight started unremarkably enough if you forget the traveling vast distances at great speed inside a metal tube. Miles in the air once seemed an impossible notion. Southwest Airlines Flight 1749, New York LaGuardia to Chicago Midway International, departed right on time. Quiet flight, smooth air, and then something happened. There was a stir near the front of the cabin. You can tell when something's amiss. A flight attendant hurried to a row on the left side. The woman seated by the window had lost consciousness. I was two rows behind her on the aisle and could see all of this and hear most of it. The flight attendant, and I would later learn that her name is Nissa Seebach, and that she was worked for Southwest for 24 years, was the same one who had greeted passengers cheerily when we boarded. Now her face was serious. She was calm, professional, fully focused. She knelt, speaking to the woman as she regained consciousness. Then she hit the call button above the seats. In response, one of her colleagues hastened to her side. He made an announcement on the public address system. Will any medical professionals on board please come to the front of the plane? The crew member retrieved the plane's emergency medical kit. Within seconds, a fellow passenger, a physician, was on his knees taking the woman's pulse and going through a checklist of medical queries. She was able to answer. Another man quickly joined him. I'm an EMT, he said to Ms. Seebach. Seemingly satisfied that the physician had things under control, he said, I'll be back in my seat if you need anything. 38,000 feet in the air, a stranger was in trouble, and these people, without an instant's hesitation, were stepping up to help. In this allegedly fractious world of ours, none of them knew or cared about the other's political beliefs. The woman who fell ill, the flight attendants, the physician, and the EMT were of different ethnicities, and they'd never met. That mattered not at all. We live in litigious times, but it seemingly didn't occur for a moment to the two medical men that it might have been easier not to get involved. Someone needed them. The woman by the window stabilized, and the physician quietly spoke to Ms. Seebach before returning to his seat. As the flight continued, Ms. Seebach periodically checked on and comforted the woman. When things go wrong in this world, it makes the front pages. When things go right, when people come through for each other, it's not considered news. Flight 1749 landed in Chicago, and we all disembarked into an America that we are constantly told is angry and full of distrust. That was Crisis and Compassion at 38,000 feet. And that brings us to the end of today's Wall Street Journal for Friday, November 22nd, 2024. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.